Hello, and welcome to ShakesPod, Silicon Valley Shakespeare's podcast. I'm Angie Higgins, Silicon Valley Shakespeare's Artistic Director. In the spirit of Silicon Valley Shakespeare's motto, to innovate, illuminate, and inspire, our podcast brings you a mix of behind-the-scenes interviews, performances, and exploration into the weird and wonderful world of Shakespeare. While we shall all beware the Ides of March this month, today we'll be taking a deep dive into Shakespeare's political drama, Julius Caesar. I'd like to welcome our very own resident dramaturg, Dahl Picado, presenting a Bard Talk, giving us some insightful history into the politics of Julius Caesar. Take it away, Dahl.
My name is Dahl Picado, and this is Bard Talk. When one thinks of Shakespeare's great tragedies, the mind immediately hits on Hamlet, King Lear, or Romeo and Juliet. Those are the biggies. Nearly every student has been introduced to Romeo and Juliet at some point in their schooling. It's very often the first Shakespeare play we experience. But when you mention Julius Caesar, the most a lot of folks can tell you about it is Beware the Ides of March. Shakespeare's Roman plays just don't jump to mind as quickly. I mean, everyone knows what happened to Julius Caesar. We learn about this in school when we learn about ancient Rome. Julius Caesar was warned by a soothsayer to beware the Ides of March, March 15th, and was repeatedly told not to go to the Capitol on that day. But he goes, despite all the warnings and omens, and is stabbed in the Capitol by a group of Roman senators. And this eventually leads to the fall of the Roman Republic and the start of the Roman Empire. So when we read the title, The Tragedy of Julius Caesar, clearly the tragedy must be the death of Julius Caesar, right? Well, not exactly. Now, slight spoilers ahead for the Alfred Hitchcock film Psycho. If you have not seen the movie, do so immediately. It's iconic. Or you can skip ahead about 47 seconds. The story begins with Marion Crane, played by Janet Leigh, who cannot marry the man she loves because of his debts. At her job, a client leaves a $40,000 cash deposit on a property, and Marion's boss asks her to deposit it. You see where this is going. Seizing her chance, she takes the money and starts driving to meet her lover. We, as the audience, are with her the whole time. This is Marion Crane's story. We are supposed to relate to her and feel what she's feeling. She's prominently displayed on the movie poster. This movie is about Marion Crane. And that is exactly what director Alfred Hitchcock wants us to think. He wants us firmly planted on that rug before he pulls it out from under us. Approximately 47 minutes into the movie, we realize that Marion Crane is not the protagonist, and also that we may never shower again. We see the same sort of thing in Shakespeare's Tragedy of Julius Caesar. It's easy for us to put what we know about history together with the fact that Julius Caesar is the title character and think, oh yeah, this is Caesar's story. However, when reading the text or seeing the play, the assassination comes during Act 3, Scene 1, approximately halfway through the play. There are accounts of theater companies who place their intermission after the assassination, having to chase down patrons who are heading to their cars thinking that the play was over. So what else is there? Julius Caesar clearly doesn't learn any major life lessons when his life is over. So maybe his death itself isn't the tragedy. Maybe it's a tragedy for someone else or for something else. Let's keep digging. First, a little Roman history. The Roman Republic's government had three parts, much like our current American government. At the base was the assembly, made up of male citizens who voted on laws and elected government officials. Above them were the senators, 300 representatives who directed spending, proposed laws, and were advisors to the two other branches of government. On top were the consuls, two men who acted as the head of the government. One commanded the army and one ran the rest of the government. And if one consul was not able to perform his duties, the other became dictator and served as both consuls. Their term was for 1 year only, and they could not serve consecutive terms. Now in 59 BC, Julius Caesar was elected consul of Rome, with the not always on the level support from Pompey the Great, who had great popularity with the people as a military commander, and Crassus, who had a lot of money. They formed what was called the First Triumvirate and basically served each other's interests. This was unfortunate for the other consul, Marcus Calpurnius Biblius, who had the unfortunate experience of trying to govern with Caesar. This is where Caesar's power grab begins. He knew that getting the support of the people was key to gaining more power. Large groups of people are easily swayed by emotion. Just look at any political rally today. So he proposed a law to give land plots to the poor for free so they could farm it. The conservative faction of the Senate was strongly against this, including Marcus Biblius. So Caesar gets together a huge gathering of the people and gives a speech where he tells the crowd, "I want to pass this law to give you land for free, but Marcus Biblius doesn't want to help you." And then he brought forth Pompey and Crassus, both immensely popular with the people, and they expressed their support for Caesar and the bill. Now, on the day of the vote, Julius Caesar was again addressing the people when Marcus Biblius arrived to vote against the bill. He attempted to reach the podium to speak and was prevented by the crowd of people who physically carried him out of the arena and threw him into the street. After this disgrace, Marcus Biblius spent the remainder of his term in his house, periodically sending notes to the Senate saying it was a holy season and they therefore couldn't vote on anything Caesar proposed. These, of course, were ignored, and Caesar and the other members of the triumvirate effectively ruled Rome for the rest of the term. At the end of his term, Caesar went to lead Rome's army in the Gallic Wars, where his massive success earned him even more popularity, now as a conqueror, as well as a hero for the people. His popularity began to rival Pompey's. Pompey began to get jealous of Caesar's sway with the people and began to build alliances against Caesar with the conservative factions of the Senate. Crassus is killed in battle, and this causes the uneasy balance that the triumvirate had to disintegrate. Civil war breaks out in Rome with Pompey and the conservative faction of Rome versus the populares, the people who had made Caesar their champion. The end of the war comes when Pompey is assassinated in Egypt and Caesar returns to Rome in triumph. This is where we are at the start of the play. We are presented with a Caesar returning in triumph with the full support of the people. They declare him dictator perpetua, dictator forever, removing the time restriction from the term of office and putting him on par with a monarch. In the second scene of the play, we are presented with Brutus, a Stoic senator and friend of Caesar, and Cassius, another senator, jealous of the power that Caesar has. They are both concerned that Caesar's abusing his power and becoming a tyrant. Brutus is worried what a tyrant will do to the Roman Republic. Cassius is worried about how a tyrant will ruin his own chances to grab power. Cassius tries to convince Brutus to join a group of conspirators plotting against Caesar, but Brutus is not interested in harming his friend. However, Casca, another senator, arrives and relates an offstage story. Mark Antony, a soldier and supporter of Caesar, offered Caesar a crown in front of the people three times. The first time, Caesar refuses and the people cheer. The second time, Caesar refuses reluctantly, and the people cheer. The third time, as Casca relates, Caesar realizes that the people are cheering because he's refusing to be king rather than encouraging him to take the crown. So he feels obliged to refuse again, but it's reluctant and angry. He wants that crown badly. Brutus, upon realizing this, begins to change his mind about joining the conspirators. He's conflicted. His public morality tells him that tyranny is bad and must be destroyed, but his private morality is telling him that it's bad to murder your friend. Cassius, seeing that Brutus is beginning to change his mind, plants false letters from the people decrying Caesar's ambition. Now believing that the people are afraid of Caesar's tyranny, Brutus joins the conspirators and assassinate Caesar at the Capitol, with his friend crying out, "Et tu, Brute?" You too, Brutus? As Brutus drives his dagger home. This is his tragic error, as it were. He acts against his ideals. He believes what he is doing is for the good of the state, but in doing so, he violates his personal code of ethics. And this can only end in tragedy. The death of Caesar begins another war, with Mark Antony on one side and Brutus and Cassius on the other. As the war rages and Brutus realizes that defeat is inevitable, he calls upon Caesar and runs upon his own sword. When Mark Antony finds Brutus dead, although they were enemies, Mark Antony says, "This was the noblest Roman of them all. All the conspirators, save only he, did that they did in envy of great Caesar. He only, in a general, honest thought and common good to all, made one of them." So is this the tragedy? Brutus's actions versus his ideals? Oh, he certainly is a tragic hero. Brutus is seduced by Cassius into believing that tyranny is afoot and that he needs to act, and this leads to his death. However, Mark Antony also seduces Caesar into believing that tyranny is possible by offering him the crown three times, and this leads to his death. And the play isn't called The Tragedy of Brutus, so let's look at this play through another lens. What would Queen Elizabeth I and her subjects attending this play in 1599 think? What would she think about this play, about a man wanting to accept the role of monarch and being killed for it? As we've examined before, generally when you had a representation of a leader on stage during that time, it was a reflection of the current leader. Queen Elizabeth famously said at the premiere of Shakespeare's Richard II, "Know you not I am Richard?" She knew what was going on. Couple this with the fact that medieval literature generally portrayed Brutus as one of the biggest sinners of all time, a sinner of the worst kind, a betrayer, on par with Judas. In fact, in Dante's Inferno, Brutus is at the center of hell, being forever chewed on by the devil alongside Cassius and Judas. So what we have is Shakespeare presenting Queen Elizabeth with a play about a leader attempting to take the crown and then being betrayed and killed by a man who is then called the noblest Roman of all. This does not seem to bode well. However, Elizabeth herself had the same hatred and disdain for tyranny that Brutus himself had. This is because the early modern era saw a distinct difference between monarchy and tyranny. It was a commonplace belief in Renaissance political theory that there were three good forms of government: the monarchy, the aristocracy, and the republic, like in Rome. However, each of these were vulnerable to corruption and could become respectively tyranny, oligarchy, and mob rule. The English were devout believers in the divine right of kings, the idea that kings derived their political authority from God himself, not from their subjects. So to rebel against the king was rebellion against God himself. This doesn't mean that kings couldn't become tyrants. They could. But it was believed that God would see this errant behavior and punish the king. So if there was no punishment, it meant the king was acting according to God's wishes. And to the English, Julius Caesar was not appointed by God, so he was not a king. He was acting as a tyrant. Now, imagine England's dilemma when the divine right of kings selects them a queen. Well, this was clearly God's wish. It had to be, according to the divine right. Even so, there were many who had a distinct problem with a woman on the throne, and seeds of insurrection were sprouting all through Elizabeth's reign. As time went on, England also realized that not only had God pleased to give them a queen, he had also given them a queen who was uninterested in getting married or providing England with an heir to the throne. And this was completely opposite to God's plan. I mean, what did God create women for, if not to have children? In Tudor England, there were very clear expectations of gender roles. Men were breadwinners, and women got married and had children. God had blessed women with the capacity for childbearing, and they were expected to do it. And the stakes were much higher for a queen. Leaving an heir meant that your kingdom had guaranteed leadership and a clear path for the future. It had protection. English history remembered too well the devastation that the War of the Roses had left. With two English houses turning against each other, this civil war completely eliminated the male bloodlines of both the houses of York and Lancaster, all for possession of the throne. So what does this have to do with Julius Caesar? Well, we've been looking at some of the things Shakespeare has been showing us. The fall of Caesar, the fall of Brutus, but also the fall of the Roman Republic. After Caesar's assassination, Shakespeare spends the part after intermission showing us what happens to Rome. Civil wars, struggles for power, eventually Mark Antony's backing of Octavius Caesar, who becomes the first emperor of Rome. With no stable leadership, the ideal republic has fallen and we are left with the tyranny of an emperor. And what were the possible consequences for England if Elizabeth I did not marry or name an heir? She was 66 when this play was written, so her own children were no longer possible, but she could at least name an heir. But she steadfastly refused. She often told her subjects, quote, "I have already joined myself in marriage to a husband, namely the Kingdom of England." Now, she had good reasons for not choosing an heir. She knew that as soon as she did, factions would rise to get rid of her and place the named, most likely male, heir on the throne. As long as she didn't name anyone, she held all the cards. All her people could do was sit and fret. And Shakespeare was clearly one of the fretters. By showing the aftermath of Caesar's assassination, Shakespeare showed Queen Elizabeth what happens when a country is left without a leader. What could happen to England if she left it without a leader? Chaos, civil war, death, England fighting against itself. England was the greatest power in the world. They could lose everything to another kingdom taking advantage of the lack of leadership or destroy itself with infighting for the throne. So perhaps the title, The Tragedy of Julius Caesar, does not mean the tragedy of Caesar personally, but the tragedy of what happened as a result of Caesar. Perhaps the real victim of the tragedy is Rome itself, falling from an ideal republic to a tyrannical empire. And in that depiction, English audiences were meant to see a reflection of their own uncertain political future if their queen did not provide for them. Despite being pressured on all sides, literally from the moment she took the throne to marry and produce an heir, Queen Elizabeth stuck to her guns and refused to name anyone. Finally, on her deathbed, she named James VI of Scotland with the words that only a king was fit to succeed a queen. So after all the worries, all the stress, the throne passed smoothly and uneventfully to James, and England's monarchy did not go the way of the Roman Republic. Shakespeare's cautionary tale may be placed in ancient Rome and reflect Renaissance England, but the political themes still resonate today. In fact, 2017's Shakespeare in the Park in New York did a production of Julius Caesar that had a Caesar in a blue suit, a long red tie, and a wife with a Slavic accent who sent tweets from a golden bathtub. Although no names were mentioned other than the character names, the show was often interrupted by protesters who climbed on stage yelling that the play was a blatant attack on the right. It's remarkable that a play about ancient Rome written during the Renaissance could inspire so much passion and outrage now. The Tragedy of Julius Caesar is a political play, one that examines the conflict between power and the people, as well as the conflicts that arise between personal relationships and dedication to your country. It's a warning to those who, like the conspiring senators in the play, claim that they are acting in the interest of their country, but in fact are furthering their own individual interests. Even in his own time period, Shakespeare's audience knew that they weren't just getting a history lesson when they saw Julius Caesar. Shakespeare wrote universal truths about human nature, and it makes his plays relevant no matter the time period, place, or setting. So the next time you read or see this play, perhaps this Ides of March, think about how those truths may reflect our own current situation. These themes are not exclusive to ancient Rome or Renaissance England. They are universal. So whenever or wherever the play is set, from ancient Rome to the early modern period until right now, it feels relevant because it still is and will continue to be far into the future. In fact, as Alyssa Wilson wrote, in the play itself, the character of Cassius foreshadows this play's future to Brutus, declaring in a remarkably on-the-nose statement, "How many ages hence shall this our lofty scene be acted o'er in states unborn and accents yet unknown?" Thank you for coming to my Bard Talk.
Thank you, Doll, for another thought-provoking Bard Talk today. Tune in to our next episode of ShakesPod as we explore the writing process and what it has been like creating during a year of quarantine with local playwrights. You won't want to miss this roundtable discussion hosted by SVS veteran Ross Harkness with Anne Kabori, Max Takis, and Lauren Doyle. For those craving the classics, head on over to the SBS YouTube page to find our recent co-production of Pride and Prejudice with South Bay Musical Theatre and our benefit performance of Twelfth Night in support of the Gastric Cancer Foundation. And now, because no episode is complete without one, I'll hand it back to our resident dramaturg Doll Picotto with this episode's Bard Babble.
As Hamlet says in Act 2, Scene 2, words, words, words. This episode's Bard Babble is blood-stained. This is yet another case of Shakespeare taking two old dingy words and making a bright, shiny new word by combining them. The word blood comes from the Anglo-Saxon word blood. Pretty straightforward. The stained portion of the word has a little more colorful background. It seems to have come from the Old Norse word staina, meaning to paint, and the Middle English word distainen, meaning to discolor. Shakespeare combined these two to create the word we know today, and we hear it first in Henry IV, Part 1, Act 1, Scene 3, when Hotspur relates, "Three times they breathed, and three times did they drink upon agreement of swift Severn's flood, who, then affrighted with their bloody looks, ran fearfully among the trembling reeds, and his crisp head in the hollow bank, blood-stained with these valiant combatants." Shakespeare invented over 400 words. This has been one of them.
From SVS to all of our wonderful listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode of ShakesPod.